We have been working our way through Romans 9, and we're in the next to the last paragraph. Lord willing, 2 weeks from tonight, we'll start verse 30, and that'll be the last paragraph in chapter 9. And we're going to be looking at verse 27, 28, and 29 this evening, where Paul is validating some of his claims regarding God's plans for Jews and Gentiles. We've been working our way into what I call the clarification of God's larger plan, and we've seen that Paul considered God's commitment to make certain people who had been called not my people into my people. That's what we were looking at last time in the quotation from Hosea. And the issue there was that when Hosea wrote it, it had particularly to do with some of the Jews who were declared not my people because of their apostasy and their idolatry. But Paul said that that also includes Gentiles into the technical category of people who are not my people, who will be called my people. And I basically argued last time that the reason that he can do that's this hermeneutical thing called type of meaning, where words define certain things and that expresses a type of meaning, and anything that fits into that type of meaning would then be, it would have application to them. And since the Gentiles from the Tower of Babylon were basically not my people, with a few exceptions, including one generation of Ninevites and the occasional Gentile who was a proselyte to Judaism. Generally speaking, though, the Jews believed that the people who were not the people of God were Gentiles, and the Jews were automatically the people of God, even though they knew Hosea was talking about a whole bunch of Jews. How that works, I'm not real sure. But what we're going to see this evening is that Paul moves specifically into the issue of the Jews. Verses 25 and 26 basically are focused on his argument that the Gentiles are included because they fit the category of people who have been called not my people, that God has called into a group called my people. But in verse 27, 28, and 29, he deliberately turns to the Jews. So in verse 24, the issue of the vessels of mercy whom God has called from among Jews as well as among Gentiles, verse 25 and 26 focuses on the inclusion of Gentiles, and then verse 27, 28, and 29 gives a rationale for how there needs to be a special group of vessels of mercy that are called from among the Jews. So the shift is deliberate. It's in light of verse 24, where he's talking about people who've been called from among the Jews. And with the Jewish mindset, and this is so, it's almost the same kind of mindset that exists in Christendom today, and in America particularly, there's just this automatic assumption that because I am one of the offspring of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, I'm one of the vessels of mercy, and I'm going to have an inheritance in God's plans and all that kind of stuff, even though there's no actual faith or there's no indication of any kind of new birth. Even Nicodemus didn't even know what a new birth was, and he was one of the leading teachers of Israel. And so their theology was so corrupted by then that you had all these people assuming that they were okay with God, but didn't even have a clue. And that was that way in Israel in the first century. That's why John the Baptizer was accumulating all these disciples, because he was basically telling them they were doomed if they didn't repent and be forgiven. And if they believed his message of forgiveness through repentance, they'd come out and he'd baptize them. In America today, we have that same kind of thing because we're a so-called Christian nation. And if you were born in the United States, you just automatically. We're a little past that now, so that there are lots and lots of people in our country that really don't even think about God anymore. But what we're going to do this evening is look at what Paul argues in verses 27, 28, and 29 about the condition that Israel was actually in that required, if God was going to have vessels of mercy from among the Jews, he was going to have to do some pretty significant stuff to make it happen. So the shift in regard to the Jews, shifting away from the Gentiles in verses 25 and 26, and he says, and Isaiah cries out concerning Israel. This shift brings the issue of the words of Isaiah as a part of the Jewish scriptures into play. He deliberately quotes from Isaiah, and he quotes from two texts. One is in chapter 10, verses 22 and 23, and the other is in chapter 1, verse 9. But he uses them in reverse order. Verse 27, where he says, though the number of the sons of Israel be as the sand of the sea, it is a remnant that will be saved, for the Lord will execute his word upon the earth thoroughly and quickly. Those verses come out of chapter 10 in Isaiah. And then, when he says in verse 29, just as Isaiah foretold, except the Lord of Sabaoth had left us a posterity, we would have become as Sodom and would have resembled Gomorrah. That comes from chapter 1, verse 9, which is a part of the introduction of Isaiah to the whole 66 chapters of the really long theological book called Isaiah. So, the shift has to do with the theme in chapter 9 about God's determination to show mercy. And his qualifier that he will show mercy upon whom he'll show mercy. So that there are two issues involved. One of them is that in the theology of Israel in the first century, mercy was a non-entity. They didn't like the concept of mercy. They didn't like the idea that God might forgive somebody that they hated for something that they had done by showing mercy. Their pharisaistic self-righteousness caused them to despise people who needed mercy. Not like them, of course, because they tithed and did all the right things. But they would despise people like Matthew, the tax collector, or the down and outers. And in Matthew's gospel, Matthew quotes from Jesus. On one occasion, he says, go and learn what this means. I'd rather have mercy than sacrifice. Well, that was unheard of for the Jews. That was absolutely heresy. God commands sacrifices, and he's got to get sacrifices. If you want to get along with God, you do what you're told. No, no, no. And then just three chapters later in Matthew, Jesus castigates them for not learning what it meant that I would rather have mercy than sacrifice, because he said, if you'd have learned that, like I told you two, three chapters ago, you wouldn't have condemned the righteous. So mercy was one of those words that the Jews used that didn't have any real significant context or content in their thinking. They would say their God was merciful, but they didn't want him to be, and they didn't expect him to be. In that way, as we said last week, they're very much like Islam. Allah the Merciful is their pet phrase, but they don't expect mercy from him. They don't give mercy to anybody that they don't agree with. Their religion is brutally merciless, and so is their God. So, this whole issue of chapter 9 is a big ticket thing because it has to do with vessels of mercy that are going to inherit the benefits of God taking special pains to make sure that they are forgiven and have the blessings of eternity with life in mind. So, when Paul quotes from Isaiah 10, he says, Isaiah cries out concerning Israel, though the number of the sons of Israel be as the sand of the sea, it is, and we could stick in parenthesis only, closed parenthesis, it is only the remnant that will be saved. It's clear that that's his meaning because he says, though the number of the sons of Israel are as the sand of the sea, there will only be a remnant that's going to be saved. And that is a very clear declaration that God's dealings with Israel are not going to be with the vast majority of Israel. And that's been historically true. Paul acknowledges that Isaiah anticipated the numerical growth of Israel to be so great as to reach this level of significance that the phrase, as the sand of the sea, signifies. That phrase has shown up repeatedly in my reading through the Old Testament in recent days, so I just stopped and counted them. There are 13 times that in the books of the Old Testament, the phrase, as the sand of the sea, refers to an enormous number. This army came out against Joshua, and they had all these 900 chariots of iron, and all these soldiers that were like the sand of the sea in number. And he's just trying to picture a huge number of people. I mean, he could have counted them, I suppose. But they just used this phrase, as the sand of the sea. And it shows up that way very consistently. All 13 times that I found it in the Old Testament, it has to do with this numerical thing about how big it's going to be. And Isaiah is basically just acknowledging that the sons of Israel are going to expand until they're like the sands of the sea for number. The word actually, a number, is the word arithmos, which we get arithmetic from. So the number is going to be enormous. There's a huge block of people. But God's dealings are not going to be with that huge block, that huge number. Though the children of Israel are like the sand of the sea, it'll be a remnant that God pulls into this vessels of mercy category. And that is really in harmony with multiple examples of God's rejection of the majority, where he declares only a remnant will be saved. And he does it on purpose because of the way men think, and we'll get to that in just a minute. But I want us to think about a few examples where you have this focus on a vast number of people, and there's only this little group that ends up being delivered from the disaster that's going to happen. And of course, the biggest example is in the Old Testament is the flood. In 1656 years of human history, prior to the beginning of the rain, the human race had exploded in numbers. I don't have any idea how many thousands, maybe millions of people were alive in that time. But if you basically lived 1,000 years and you had kids all the time, because bodies were still pretty virile and there wasn't a lot of miscarriaging and all that kind of stuff. The fact is, the population of the world had grown enormously, and the behavior of the people was so bad that God said, I'm sorry, I got this started. I'm going to wipe y'all out. And he told Noah to build a boat, and Noah and his wife and his daughters and their husbands, and what, there were 8 people out of all those people that became vessels of mercy. So that's the first and biggest example of this whole concept of, as the sands of the sea, there will only be this small group. The next, probably most impressive example, is the number of people that came out of Egypt at the time of God's judgment on the nation of Egypt, with all those plagues that brought about the expulsion of the children of Israel from Egypt. And there, they numbered the men of war 20 years old and upward, and there's over 600,000 of them. And so we extrapolate from that how many people left Egypt. And it can be anywhere from a low number, like 1.5 million, up to maybe 5 or 6 million, depending on how many people you figure were in a household in that period of time, where there are 600,000 men who are over 20 and under, well, it's probably somewhere from 20 to 50, but it just says they counted everybody from 20 years old and upward, and they come up with these 600,000 warriors. Well, if the majority of those men were married, then you have 1,200, you have 1 million, two, just the man and the wife. And if they have 2.4 kids, you know, if they have 5 or 6 kids, then all of a sudden you've got this huge number of people. And you stop and think about how long did it take them to get across the Dead Sea with the water standing up? How far back did the water stand up? How much space was actually there? It wasn't like on the Ten Commandments where the thing is a couple hundred yards wide, because you'd never get 6 million people through there in a night. It couldn't happen. You just, the logistics don't work. So if there was that massive number of people, then the wall of water backed up a long ways off, and they all went across in a big rush, real wide thing. And then they got across, and here comes Pharaoh chasing them. And then, you all know the story. But with that number of people coming out of Egypt, there were only 2 that went into the promised land out of that generation, 20 years old and upward. That's a massive reduction to a remnant. You stop and think about, here's 5 or 6 million people that are promised the promised land. And they rebel against God and rebel against God and whine and complain and carry on so often, so many times, that God finally says, okay, I'm done. You're not going in. Anybody that was 20 years old and upward when y'all left Egypt, none of you are going into the land except Joshua and Caleb. Not even Moses got to go in. And he was not allowed to go in for fault. God says, you refused to glorify me. I told you to speak and you struck in regard to the rock. So there's another example of though the children of Israel are like the sands of the sea, it's only two that get to go into the promised land of that original generation. And then you get at the tail end of the disaster that was known as Israel. In 722, 10 of the tribes of Israel were carried away captive by Assyria, and the decimation of the tribes and the scattering of them among Assyria and the other places wherever they ended up going was so potent that they never returned. There was no more heard of the 10 tribes. There's no history about where they went or how. They just scattered among the peoples of the earth. And then less than a little over 100 years later, Babylon comes in and carries off the first wave of the people that they're going to carry into captivity from Judah, from the two tribes. And in all of those people that were carried off, the number is like the sand of the sea. You have Daniel and Mishael and Azariah and Hananiah that end up playing a significant part as vessels of mercy within the problem of Israel's rebellion and God's discipline and dispersing them among the nations. So you get this feeling that this is kind of this the way it is, that God has this plan, and he's had this plan in mind for a long time, and he's working to deal with it, but he is not working with the masses. He's working with the remnant, a small group. So Paul emphasizes that by quoting from Isaiah, and I think for a particular reason in terms of the numbers and impact, because one of the favorite major mechanisms of humanity in justifying things that they want to do or in justifying their rejection of truth, the things they don't want to believe, they almost always buttress their attitude of rebellion or unbelief with this claim that so many people can't be wrong. I mean, that's the argument that has always been dominant in both Judaism and in Roman Catholicism, that God certainly would not have allowed that many people to be that wrong that long. They've got to be right, because everybody knows that they, and that argument just doesn't hold any water at all when it comes to Scripture. And yet, it's a favorite for men. We take a great deal of support from the number of people we can point to that agree with us. There is this penchant for man to get his sense of security in relation to the things about which he is most insecure, and that's in relation to God. They get their sense of security from the number of people that are involved in whatever it is they believe, and they can point to them and say, with this many people believing it, they've got to be right. I'm included because I agree with them. And since God's whole focus throughout all the Scriptures is on people believing him, being very particular about, you believe what I tell you, with God, it really doesn't matter if nobody believes him in terms of the numbers game, because he's not interested in numbers. He's interested in people that believe him. And so you have Adam and Eve dropping the ball, and immediately at the initial thing, God says, this is the way it is, and Adam and Eve don't believe him, and so they end up introducing sin to the creation. And then you have all of these thousands of years that go by where people justify their unbelief by pointing to these vast numbers, and Isaiah says, I don't care if the number of Israel is like the sand of the sea. That's not going to influence God. He is going to have this group of the vessels of mercy that will be saved, and he calls them the remnant. So I think that one of the first things that Isaiah was doing and that Paul was doing in verse 27 was emphasizing the fact that God's plan has never been a plan for majority. And with men, that's just inconceivable. I've even heard people say, or read what they've written, where God is considered a failure if he doesn't save more people than Satan deceives. And conflict with Lucifer and the fallen angels and all this stuff, if God doesn't end up with more people in heaven than they end up with people in hell, then God failed. And this flies in the face of that. That's not true. But it's a favorite thing of the deception. And then secondly, I think that one of the issues that he's dealing with here in verse 28, where he says, "For the Lord will execute his word upon the earth thoroughly and quickly." Now, those words need to be understood. But what he's doing here is he's telling us that the Lord is going to execute his word. He is going to do what he said. And this is, I think, entirely within the overall context of chapter 9, because the entire context of this chapter, which started out with love and then hate and then God deciding to have mercy, and it's not unrighteous for him to show mercy, and it's not unrighteous for him to call certain people and not others and all that. He simply says that God is determined to save by showing mercy to a group called the vessels of mercy. So there are going to be vessels of wrath, because God wants to show his wrath, and there are going to be vessels of mercy, and he's going to show his mercy through them. And his purposes in both cases are not primarily focused on the individuals that are involved. God did not show me mercy for my sake alone, or even primarily for my sake. He showed mercy for me, to me, for the sake of others that would be benefited by the display of his mercy to me. Paul said that in his letter to Timothy. He said, God saved me as a first-class reprobate, in order to demonstrate just how merciful he's willing to be to anybody, because I was the chief of sinners and he was willing to have mercy on me. So he was basically saying, God didn't save me because I was the worst possible candidate for salvation on the planet, which is what he meant, I was the chief of sinners. But he didn't save me for my sake. He saved me so that all those people out there could learn about his mercy from the way he treated me for their sake. And I think this is a huge part of the issue of our thinking about how God is working and why he's doing what he's doing, to get our eyes off ourselves and to put them on the people that God puts his eyes on. Yes, he's showing mercy to me for my sake, but not primarily for my sake. And I need to get over this whole idea that it's all about me. It's not. God does what he does for the sake of those vessels of mercy that he was going to show his life. He's going to express his life to, going to give them the joy of life for all eternity. And he's going to do it by having this category, this group called the vessels of mercy. So God is determined to show mercy, to make possible the experience of life for those who believe in that mercy. And this determination, as we've already said, is determination in opposition to that deeply ingrained legalistic self-righteousness of men for whom showing mercy is not a good thing in their thinking. Jonah was one of the classic examples of a man who was absolutely opposed to God showing mercy. He did not want to go to Nineveh because he did not want God to show them mercy. And he had this strong suspicion that if he went, God would show mercy. He didn't want that to happen. So he jumped on a boat to go somewhere else. That whole story is about God being willing to show compassion, to have mercy on vessels of mercy. And it shows that the natural inclination, the Jewish theological mind was, no, you don't forgive my enemies. You give them what they got coming because they got coming because of the way they treated me. And God is saying all this time, look, it ain't about you. You need to get over this. It's all about me thing. And then the determination is also not just to force the issue of a display of mercy in a setting where sin is dominant and people don't want God to be merciful, but it's also at the root of the focus of the promise faith concept. Because God's display of mercy is rooted in the issues of his promises and men's faith in those promises. That's the methodology. The only other methodology God is the command performance one. And under command performance, there will be no mercy. Under command performance, you do what you're told or else. Well, that's justice. And under that system, there will be no mercy. You got it coming, you're going to get it. And they, in their self-righteousness, actually thought that they had some good coming. But they've ignored the testimony of their own hearts and the testimony of their history that they don't have any good coming because they haven't done anything good enough to qualify for having any good coming. They don't accept that. And that's one of the things that was most offensive about Paul's gospel. The Jews didn't want to be considered to be sinful to that degree. But the fact is, God has set up this whole issue of, I'll make a commitment to you to fulfill my promise of eternal life to you if you'll trust me. Promise, faith. And that's the fundamental mechanism of the vessels of mercy concept. So this determination to show mercy by making promises that become believable because God's persuasive ability is involved, it's set into the context of a phrase that Paul uses in another place called the mystery of iniquity. And what he's talking about is the way that sin gradually gets a greater and greater grip on the person that's involved in it, so that the bondage to sin gets deeper and deeper every day that goes by. He that commits sin becomes a servant of it, and every day it gets more dominion over him, so that finally the vast majority of humanity are completely ruined by sin. And God's declaration that there will be a remnant that will be saved is a declaration that he's going to interrupt that process for the vessels of mercy. And that's no small thing. So the whole point here is that God has deliberately intended merciful actions to create a group called the vessels of mercy. And in this context, it's from the Jews. That group of people that he had decided he's going to show mercy to some of them in spite of all their rebellion against him. And so according to Paul, the issues involved in this Isaiah 10 thing in verses 27-28 include God's commitment to show mercy and his method of promised faith. Now, in respect to that commitment of promised faith, the second part of the quote, verse 28, is the Lord will execute his word. That's the bottom line of promised faith. God makes commitments in words. And the encouragement is God will do what he said he will do. The only problem with that is that he does require that the men who are going to benefit from the promises have to believe. If you rebel against the promise, don't want to accept it, don't want to believe it, then obviously it can't do you any good. This is God functioning in a relational universe where he's trying to reestablish harmony between persons, and people who are determined not to believe whatever is told to them are determined not to have this reconciliation happen. So, in respect to that commitment, Paul just says that Isaiah said, the Lord will execute his word. Even Isaiah said, Lord, who has believed our report? But Isaiah also said, the Lord will execute his word. And I'm not sure, but isn't it in Isaiah that says that the word will not depart, will not be void? It will accomplish the thing that God sent it for? That's the whole issue of promised faith. And in this, the doing, the Lord will execute his word upon the earth. That execute is actually the word to do. He will do what he said on the earth. And then he has two participles. Thirdly and quickly is the way the New American Standard translates it. Now there is in the Septuagint an inclusion of the concept of righteousness, which is included in the King James translation. It's not in the best manuscripts, and the New American Standard leave out the focus on righteousness. He just says the Lord will execute his word upon the earth. And then they say thoroughly and quickly. But the issue of thoroughly is the word, it's only used here, but it has to do with he's going to do exactly and everything that he said in his word. It will be a complete, thorough accomplishment of the end that is established. It even uses the word end in the composition of the word, so that God's going to do everything that he said, and he'll do the particulars of everything he said. He's going to execute it on the earth, everything that he said. And then the second part of the quote is translated quickly, but it's problematical. That word is only used one time in the New Testament. And it's a word that means, that actually comes from being chopped up finely, in a very fine way. I watched our host, he's a cook by gift, I guess. He loves to cook. But I've watched him many, many times as he gets ready to make his salad or whatever, sauces, or he takes his knife and he puts his stuff on this cutting board and he chop, 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 until there's just this finely chopped conglomeration of whatever it was he put on there. And that's the actual meaning of this word that's translated quickly. And I don't really know why they wanted to go with the idea of quickness, when the idea is actually a very fine chopping. And to me, it makes all the sense in the world that he is going to execute his word upon the earth. He's going to do exactly what he said, and he's going to do it by chopping everything up finely, in a very fine way. It's going to chop it into many, many, many pieces. Because that's the issue of the destruction. He's going to execute his word upon the earth thoroughly, so that those who believe him are going to get every particle of everything he promised and all the details of it. But those who reject it are going to be as if they were chopped up into tiny little pieces. In fact, didn't we already run into that idea that they will be like the dust of the threshing floor that are blown away? So I really believe that the two participles, thoroughly and chopped finely, are modifying how God's going to execute his word, because there are two parts to the word. The word has this issue of promise, and if you believe it, you get everything that's promised. But it's got a built-in consequence if you don't believe it, because the only thing that's left for people who don't believe it is that they fall into this category, the vessels of wrath. So God's going to have these vessels of mercy, and he's going to, for them, fulfill everything that he's declared that they've trusted him for. And then there are these others, this sand of the sea group that are part of the vessels of wrath, and he's going to destroy them absolutely, completely. So the words are really not that difficult. He is just declaring that Isaiah cried these things out, and he exposed the reality of God focusing on a remnant that will be saved, because he's going to execute his word upon the earth, and he's going to do both the thorough deliverance as well as the thorough destruction. It's the vessels of mercy and the vessels of wrath. But then in verse 29, he goes one more step. He goes back to the introduction of Isaiah, in which, in chapter 1, verse 9, he said, Isaiah foretold, and this is what he foretold, except the Lord of Sabaoth had left to us a posterity, we would have become as Sodom and would have resembled Gomorrah. Well, what's he declaring? What he's saying there is, the words are not really hard. Paul is moving back to the introduction of this book that he's quoted from already in verse 27, 28. But he goes back to that because in that introduction, which is introduction in a very real sense to the whole prophecy of Isaiah, he says that there is this long shadow of the dominion of sin over the people of God's creation. And it is a profoundly negative thing, where people get caught by sin, and then they sin again, the hooks get deeper, and then in a little while they're so dominated by sin that there's just absolutely, as far as any kind of human expectation, there's no hope. And that's the testimony of history in relation to sin. People just get enmeshed in it, and then they get deeper in it, and after a while, their families give up on them, and then they finally give up on themselves, because that's the despair of being so bound by something that you can't escape. And basically what he's saying is, look, this process starts out like this. You commit a sin. You become a servant of it. And you end up like Sodom and Gomorrah. It goes inexorably that way. So, the text is a part of Paul's argument that God's determination is to show mercy on vessels of mercy from among the Jews. The history of the Jews is a history of consistent rebellion, refusal, disobedience, and all of that. And in a very real sense, God didn't do the Jews any favor at all by setting them up as an example of what it was like for people to be exposed to the justice of God while they were in bondage to sin. Because that was Israel's condition. They were in bondage to sin, and then God set up the justice system, and it automatically meant disaster unless there was some significant work done. And so Paul's saying that a person who's ensnared will eventually end up in the worst case scenario, because that's what Sodom and Gomorrah end up being. Sodom and Gomorrah were two cities whose progression into sin was so profound that God sent angels from heaven to rain fire and brimstone down on them and destroy them. And he did it in the context of Abraham praying, would you spare the city if you found a few, you know, that believed your promise? Would you? How about 50? Yeah. How about 40? Yeah. How about 30? Yeah. Finally, he says, don't be mad, but one more time. How about 10? God said, for the 10, I'll spare the whole thing. But there weren't 10 there. That's the problem. And so what Paul is saying is, God set up a program where he's going to save vessels of mercy out from among the Jews, but he's going to do it in light of the truth about sin and the Jews. And if the Lord hadn't done something, the Lord of Sabaoth, that word means hosts, the Lord of hosts, the Lord of the armies of all of heaven, it's a demonstration or a characterization of God as enormously powerful. If the powerful, powerful Lord had not left us a posterity, we would have inevitably and inexorably become the moral and disastrous equivalent of Sodom and Gomorrah. That's where Israel was headed when God decided he would show mercy on vessels of mercy. And it requires us to believe that the problem of interrupting that process is an enormous problem. But God addressed the enormity of it by the most powerful and enormous demonstration by sending his own son to Calvary to solve the problem. And you just can't conceive of the God of creation making that level of sacrifice unless it was absolutely necessary. And the thing that made it absolutely necessary was the degree of the depravity that humanity had been plunged into when Adam ate the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So it was a huge problem, but God met it with a huge solution. The more we understand the problem, the greater we'll appreciate the solution. So that's what Paul is doing here in this paragraph. He's dealing with the issues of God's determination to show mercy and explaining to us why that determination needed to be in order for there to be any help for any of us. God hadn't have been determined to show mercy, he just let it go. But he didn't, because he said certain things, and he was going to fulfill those certain things to the people who believed him, among whom Abraham is the classic. He's the father of those who believe him. Abraham believed him, and from then on, God was on the hook to do what he said he'd do. But he didn't mind, because that's what integrity is all about. Now, next time, we're going to raise the question of verse 30. What shall we say to these things?